The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
How are you all doing? Good. I'm Emily August. I'm actually from the National Museum of American Jewish History. I'm the programs manager over there, and we are thrilled to be co-presenting tonight's program with Lori Rubin. So special thanks to the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation for letting us co-present. On to the program at hand. We're here tonight for Lori Rubin and her book, Do You Dream in Color? Insights from a Girl Without Sight. As I said, you'll be getting a proper introduction, so I just want to say a word about the museum's interest and connection to this program. Certainly, Lori's Jewish heritage is of interest to the museum, but we're particularly inspired by what we would call a dreamers and doers story. We're a museum that traces the stories of how Jewish immigrants became Jewish Americans. And through that lens, we inspire visitors of all backgrounds, or we hope to inspire visitors of all backgrounds, to think about how their own heritage and identity both shapes and is shaped by the American experience. So, you know, sort of consequently, the stories that we explore in the galleries are those of hard work, aspiration, imagination, innovation, courage. And these are certainly all adjectives that we could use to describe Lori. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Carrie Wilkins of the Free Library of Philadelphia's Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, and enjoy the program.
My name is Carrie Wilkins, and I am the director of the Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. I'm very happy to be here tonight to introduce Lori Rubin, but first, a few reminders. Please silence your cell phones and refrain from using flash photography. And following the talk, please join us upstairs in the lobby for a book signing. Blind since birth, mezzo-soprano Lori Rubin is the recipient of numerous accolades, having performed at the White House, the John F. Kennedy Center for Performing Arts, and Carnegie Hall, as well as the Burbank Philharmonic Orchestra and the Yale Symphony Orchestra, amongst others. Do You Dream in Color is the story of her journey towards identity, underscoring the triumph of the human spirit, as she recounts her experiences from childhood through the rise of her career as an opera singer. Her prose is like lyrics I could hear as I read, fluid, luscious, palpable. And as a temporarily displaced Northern Nevadan, I was so homesick as she described her times at Lake Tahoe in the icy summer waters and learning how to ski at Kirkwood. I was inspired by her stories and her refusal to be defined by others. Lori's success, independence, determination, and strength to be true to herself should be a loud reminder to everyone that blindness is not a disability. Rather, it is only another perspective to find the best in oneself and touch the lives of others, whether through song or by the written word. I know Lori has touched me and that I am a richer person for having read Do You Dream in Color? Please join me in warmly welcoming Lori Rubin to the stage.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. I just feel so humbled and honored to be here tonight, and also so grateful to all the organizations who came together to bring me here. It's really a dream come true. You know, I used to go to book events all the time and hear these kinds of introductions made of others, and never in my wildest dreams expected that to happen to me. So it's just hearing that is pretty amazing, and that's just a testament to the fact that if you really believe in something, to go for it, because it'll eventually, if you build it, they will come, yeah? And so I guess I'll tell you a little bit about why this book came to be. When I was living in New York, which I did for 7 years, I had just come off of a grad school experience, and of course when you're in grad school, everything is regimented, you're totally protected and nurtured, and everything is wonderful and hunky-dory. And my partner and I decided, well, we're going to live in New York, because that's what artists do. You know, they go to New York and find their way and become famous. So we get to New York, and you know, we thought, okay, we're gonna get students, we're gonna have a studio. It was gonna be just fabulous. Well, on the first day of going to New York, we started walking around with flyers, and what do you know? They thought we were solicitors, yeah? Either that or some kind of, I don't know, just going door-to-door kind of people. So, you know, we thought, oh, we're teachers, and, you know, we just graduated from Yale, and, you know, Jenny, my partner, is a clarinetist and pianist, and I'm a singer, and they looked at us like, yeah, who are you? You know, we don't know you. Go away, right? And we would call schools and say, you know, we have all these, we just graduated, we master's from Yale. Well, when you're in New York, if you don't have Juilliard or Manus or Manhattan School of Music, you can forget about it, right? And it was like we got the hang up, you know, that you get for like a telemarketer. And the other thing is that when we moved to New York, the thing about being an artist is that you have to prove yourself. But for me, and this was sort of a lifelong theme, proving myself was about proving who I was, not only as an artist, but there was the additional layer of the onion of blindness. And so when I would come into an audition, what people would see was not what I was about to do when I was about to do a musical recitation of some Schubert or Schumann or Brahms. What they would hear and see was all these questions. How is she going to move around on stage? How are we going to get her from point A to point B? How, all of these hows and what are we going to do? And there was one time I did a competition, and the people that were judging, all they could remember was how they had watched me walk in with a guide dog, which to me is a very liberating thing, walking in with a guide dog. But for a judge who's thinking of putting people in operas, it's baggage. And what I realized was I really needed to write a book to get people to understand that the blindness thing could be melted away, and that what I really am is somebody who desires to be an artist. I was just really wanting to continue where I had left off at Yale, and I wanted to build my career. So there was one day that it was in 2005. I had just done a competition. I made the finals. It was an international competition, so I was moving ahead in New York, finally getting my name out there. People were starting to hear me. So I made the finals of this competition, and I'm walking around the Lincoln Center area, 66th, 65th, that kind of area, with my guide dog, being totally happy about being independent in New York. And what do you know, this woman comes up to me and says, I heard you in this competition, and actually I was one of the administrators. And she started to say, the first part of her sentence was, and I've got to tell you, and I thought, oh, she's going to say something nice about how I sang, which would be very nice, and I'd say thank you and move on with my day. But what she said was, I just wanted to tell you how much we all admire you for just getting up in the morning, for just being able to face the world, even though you have such a hard life. And I thought to myself, oh no, this is not going to do. Because if I want to make a career for myself, I can't always have people thinking this, because they're not even going to be able to think that I can find the bathroom by myself. How are they going to think I can move around on stage? And so Jenny and we were sitting at dinner. There's this place really close to where we lived in New York called Isabella's. And I said to Jenny, I was just venting. I was like, we're both venting, because we were both auditioning, Jenny on clarinet and me for singing. And I said to her, when is this going to stop? When can people just hear me as a singer? And all this artistry that I've spent so many years working on and building life experience and having romance, having love, having passion, having bad things happen, having good things happen, when is that all going to add up to people recognizing me as an artist, not just as a blind person? And she turned to me, and of course, she's smarter than I. It's so funny, because last night we did an event at the 92nd Street Y, and this one lady said, and she was talking about how this event came to be and how this all got put together. And she said, you know what? It's because my partner's smarter than me. And she thought that I should make this book happen. And today, that's exactly what Jenny said. She turned to me and she said, you've got to write a book. And I looked at her, I said, write a book? I was like, do you know how much time that would take? And do you know, I'm not a writer, you know, whatever. But the thing was that she knew is that I did love to write, and that I had so much that I wanted to tell people. I had so much life experience. Well, I don't know if I would say so much life experience. I'm in my early 30s, but some people think that's pretty old. A lot of our students think that's old. So maybe that is a lot of life experience. But I had things that I wanted to say, and I thought, you know what? Why not? And so in 2008, I started writing the book. And I don't know, I know that there's probably obviously mixed political views, and so I don't mean this to be a political thing at all, but at the time, President Obama was running for president. And I remember sitting there, and this was right as I was just beginning the writing process, and I'm sitting there on the couch, and all of a sudden, we find out that he had won. And what was really remarkable to me is I'm watching the news, and Howard University is on the news, and they're showing these students bawling. They say they finally feel recognized. Their dream has come true. America has finally recognized a black president. And I sat there, and I started weeping. I mean, uncontrollably weeping. And I just, through the speech, the acceptance speech, everything, I just couldn't stop crying. And I thought, this is a dream for me, writing a book. And I'm going to make this dream come true for myself. And I had a publisher within a couple of years. That publisher folded after edits. Let me tell you, lots and lots of edits and tears and toil and getting things in by deadlines and all this. And the publisher folded. But then 2012 came around. And by that time, I had had another publisher. And what do you know? My book was published just before President Obama was reelected. And I just thought that was so cool. Things have significance and symbolism and things like that. And I just thought it was the exact cycle of my dream, writing the book right at that time when he was elected. And then, and just being symbolic about civil rights, and then having the book come out when he was reelected. I just thought that was so cool. Anyway, so the book talks about my life. And it talks about the successes I've had. It talks about the reservations people have had about my blindness. But I just wanted to bring this actually to Judaism, because I know that the Jewish Museum has done such a wonderful job of promoting this event. And Judaism is such an important part of my life. And the chapter in the book that was one of my favorites to write, and it was one of the chapters I sat there and would write and write and write, and I didn't stop until the chapter was finished. And it's called... celebrating my bat mitzvah in my pink bat mitzvah dress. It's something like that. And of course, I'm like, I should know the title of this chapter, and I just drew a blank on the chapter name. But the chapter is all about how I was 8 years old and watching my brother getting bar mitzvahed. And I wanted that so much for myself. And I went to Hebrew school, and I had this an amazing Hebrew school principal who said, Lori, you're going to be in our Hebrew school. He was the one teacher who didn't say, how is she going to do this? It wasn't the person who was trying to find all the reasons why I couldn't. He was the teacher that said, we are going to make it happen. He found the Jewish Braille Institute in New York, and he got all my materials in Braille. And he was just fantastic. And I, because of that, I learned to read Hebrew. I learned all my bat mitzvah stuff, all the haftarahs and the Torah portions. And one of the amazing things that happened that day, I was so nervous. And I thought, okay, if I can, and all kids are nervous. But I remember thinking that there was kind of a ruckus. There was something going on in the synagogue, and I had no idea what that was. All I knew was that there was just tons of commotion. So I'm standing there, and I'm just doing my thing, and I'm like, okay, I'm not going to let this bother me, all this noise, and I was like, I guess it's not a natural disaster, because nobody's told me to stop chanting. At the end, I found out that what had happened was not only were my guests, and of course, you know, at the requisite bar mitzvah, you got 100 or 200 people, and, they're all there at 9:30, they all come late, at a conservative service that starts at 8:45 in the morning, they get there at 9:30, so I knew that was going to happen. But what had happened was, because I was the first blind bat mitzvah at my synagogue, everybody and their mother and their grandmothers and their aunties from Encino and the San Fernando Valley came to my bat mitzvah because they wanted to know how a blind person was going to read from the Torah. Well, it's not rocket science. You put a Braille Siddur on top, or a Braille Torah portion on top of the Torah, and there you have it. When they realized this, they were probably heartily disappointed, but... And I was just a normal kid just going, But there you have it. And it was one of the most important days of my life, because it was, once again, not only did I feel, I just felt like I was a trailblazer in a certain way as a blind person, but I also, my Torah portion was Joseph and the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, well, as per Andrew Lloyd Webber language. And so the whole thing to me is about dreams, interpreting dreams, being different. And I thought, Joseph's problem was that he wasn't treated equally by his family. And I made a, you know, the little speech that you make for your bat mitzvah, and it was really felt so relevant to my life. But anyway, that's, you know, one of the big things. And the other thing is that my singing career got started because when people got wind in my family and friends, when they got wind of the fact that I started taking voice lessons, they started inviting me to sing the national anthem at every single Jewish charity dinner in Los Angeles. So the ADL and the UJF and Hadassah and whatever, B'nai B'rith, everything, you name it. I was there singing the national anthem at some point. And at these events where people like the lady Margaret Thatcher and Walter Matthau, Alan King, George Burns, many have since passed, and it's showing my age, right? But anyway, so these things, you know, at an early age sort of got rid of that stage fright. And one of the things that had happened as part of that was when I was 14 years old, and I'm giving away the whole book, but anyway, well not really. This is just a part of it. But when I was 14 years old, I was asked to sing at this thing for Pan Pacific Park, which was the 50th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And there was 4,000 people there. And I sang some pieces. One was Sprint, and it was talking about the village burning. And we're just standing there letting it burn. And it's just a gorgeous, heart-wrenching song. So after I sang, the mayoral candidates for California, and of course we had had Tom Bradley since the flood, it was a big deal when we had a new mayor. So both mayoral candidates came up to me and said hi, and because that's what they do. And even though I was 14, they were trying to win my parents' votes, right? So Mayor Richard Reardon comes up to me and says, if I win, you're going to sing the national anthem at my inauguration. I was like, well, that's a nice little promise, you know, and I was kind of hoping he was kidding. And I was kind of hoping that he wouldn't win because just in case he wasn't kidding, I'd have to sing, and that's the hardest song to sing. But he wasn't kidding. And I sang at his inauguration, and I thought, if I can do this in front of all these people and in front of the media, I think I could do anything. And that's really why my career took off. I have to really credit the Jewish community for that. But I'm just going to read to you a couple of little things from the book. This first is called I Can Read Too. And people ask me the question, Lori, when did you figure out that you were blind? I was like, well, my whole life, I don't know. but I guess what they were trying to say is, what made you realize that blindness was something different than the rest? It was this philosophical question about, like, how did you know you weren't like everyone else? And this is the answer, the only answer to that that I can remember. I sat amongst my pile of discarded toys, waiting for some sort of inspiration to take hold. Brian sat on the couch, quietly reading. Every now and then, I heard a page turn. The playroom was the place in the house in which Brian and I spent most of our time. Slightly down the hall from our neighboring bedrooms, it had the welcoming aura of a more communal space and was home to all of Brian's and my toys. Dad, who was a partner CEO of a toy company, often brought home blaster balls coated in gunpowder, animals made of soft plastic, and a variety of toys that sat neglected on shelves, while Brian and I coveted the toys from other companies we saw advertised on commercials. "What are you reading?" I asked. "A book called Watership Down," Brian mumbled. "What's it about?" "Lori, it's a long story." My four-year-old mind could not wrap itself around the fact that my nine-year-old brother considered reading to be more important than answering my questions. "Can I read, too?" "Not now," he said firmly. "Why not?" "Because I don't want to start reading to you from the beginning." My heart sank. "But, Brian, you always read to me. How come you won't read to me this time?" "Can't I just read to myself for a little while?" he asked, exasperated. "Brian," I asked more timidly, as though treading on thin ice, "let me read the book." "Lori, you can't." "Why not?" "Well, for one thing, you're not even old enough to read." "Not old enough? Let me see it." After a long pause, Brian let out a sigh. "Here," he said, handing me the book. "Just don't move the bookmark or else I'll lose my place." I held the book in my hand. It had a hard cover that felt the tiniest bit rough. Other than that, there seemed to be nothing interesting about it. I began to turn the pages, marveling at the fact that I was making the same sound as my brother was just before I had interrupted him. I felt each page. I was bewildered. There appeared to be nothing on the pages. My hands could only discern smooth, blank paper. "Brian, there's nothing here to read," I said, thinking I had just discovered him playing a joke on me. Yes, there is, Lori. You just can't see it. No, Brian, I'm looking at the pages. There's nothing there. That's because you're touching the pages, not seeing them. What do you mean, seeing them? Lori, it's hard to explain. Can I have my book back now? I handed it back, and he resumed reading. It just didn't seem fair that the book should be revealing secrets to him that its pages wouldn't share with me. What was Brian getting out of this book that I couldn't find by touching it? The pages had been much thinner and much less interesting than the pages of my favorite scratch and sniff books that smelled like strawberry or chocolate or even skunk. Nor was it as fun to touch as the books with cutouts of animals, with button eyes and coats of a material that emulated fur. This was something my brother could do that I couldn't, not only because he was older, but because I couldn't see. I had no idea what seeing really meant, but I was determined to find out. Though Brian's books never revealed their mysteries within to my fingers, there was a vast array of books waiting for me that did. It was those books that taught me that to see that the richly perfumed roses with satin-textured petals in the backyard were a deep red, that the smiling light from the sun I could see with my limited vision was lighting up a vivid blue sky filled with birds of all shapes and sizes. Even though these books described gardens far away from where I lived, I knew that my favorite characters and I were experiencing the same virtues of nature. It didn't stop there. Princesses dressed in pale pink silk fabric encrusted in sparkling crystals, who sat in chairs clad in rich brocade, became real to me whenever I dressed for family parties or whenever Mom peeked into an antique shop to admire the furniture. At first, Mom, Grandma, or Brian read these books to me, for I was still too young for the books I would later read in what they called Braille. In the meantime, I was driven 45 minutes away to the Blind Children's Center in downtown Los Angeles, where my teachers helped me discern different textures as a way of giving my fingers practice for the six-dot Braille system I would learn in kindergarten. Instead of being given pictures of animals or different shapes, they would hand me a ball, a toy horse, or a set of keys, and taught me to interact with the world with my hands, my ears, and my nose. Though there was no getting around the fact that I was different and that my childhood routine of going to an unusual school by bus was vastly different than the one Brian knew at his neighborhood school, we both settled ourselves down in the playroom couch in the evenings after we had finished our homework, curled up with our favorite books. After a while, I was unaware of the sounds of both of our pages turning and the soothing terrain of the Braille under my fingers. The clocks ticking and the sound of Mom and Dad's TV dissolved as we traveled far away into mysteries with Nancy Drew or into Renaissance England with Shakespeare. Brian continued to read books with his eyes, and I read mine with my fingers, but we were both able to see just fine. Oh, thank you. And this is dedicated to our lovely host here who introduced me, because she said something about being from Nevada. And this is about skiing, although this part of the chapter that I'm going to read is actually in Utah. No offense to Nevada. It's just this is where I learned. This is sort of the point at which I was able to ski by myself with my family. And I had a ski guide behind me or sometimes in front of me saying, left, right. Oh, shoot. I meant left. Lori, left. It's a couple of near misses, almost hitting trees, but I'm still alive, so everything, I mean, not too brain damaged. Well, at least not that I know of. You never know. But we'll see. Okay. Julie skied with me through many more trips to Tahoe, but did not get to witness my maiden voyage on a blue run 2 winters later. Brad, a man more than 6 feet tall with a deep voice, had been telling me about a green run called Success, my whole first ski day in Deer Valley, Utah, promising me that if I was good, that would be our second-to-last run that day. The last would be home, a short course, but nevertheless, my very first blue run. The bright winter sun was smiling on us, promising to be my companion, cheering me on for my last 2 runs of the day. Here we are, Brad said, as we stopped at the top of Success. Are you ready? Yeah, I said. Okay, on your mark, get set, go. I was off. The snow was a lush, rich blanket of gentle powder beneath me, rippling with tiny peaks and valleys. The air was almost balmy, promising an early spring. My skis whistled and hissed through the fluffy snow. Then, with no warning, the roller coaster began in full force. The run was now steeper than anything I had skied before. I was falling in slow motion, and yet I was still standing. Brad began calling, "Left, right, left," to me over the cries of our skis. My heart raced with the effort of keeping up. "There are a few bumps in the snow coming up," I heard Brad yell to me. "Ah!" I screamed and began to teeter dangerously as moguls began to appear from underneath my feet. Up and down I went over tiny mountains of snow, but I was still upright, and upon that realization, I began to relax, even as the moguls continued to taunt my skis. My screams turned into "Wee!" And once again, I was that little girl on Grandpa's sled. "Okay, you're hitting smooth ground again," Brad shouted. Suddenly, there was no skis and no snow, just pure sensation. I was flying. I turned effortlessly with Brad's directions, and the breeze seemed to be carrying me. "Okay, you're in the home stretch, but it's gonna get steeper." The breeze that had carried me let me go with no warning, and I was falling again. Down, down, down I went, still upright and in slow motion like a dream. And then it was over. The ground inclined slightly before leveling off.
"And stop," Brad said, a smile apparent in his voice. "All I can say, kid, is that we should be heading home, or should I say, for a home run."
As we rode the chairlift to home, Brad said,
"In my opinion, whoever labeled success a green run had a nasty sense of humor."
"What do you mean?" I asked.
"Well, success is technically much harder than many more intermediate runs you'll ski, home being one of them. Home is kind of steep, but a piece of cake after success."
The sun was still beaming down as we approached home.
"We're here," Brad said, as we got into position. "But before we start, I've got a little surprise for you."
"Great skiing, Lori," said Brian's voice in the distance. "My family's here," I gasped.
"Yup," Brad said. "They've been watching you all afternoon. You're skiing the intermediate runs now," he reminded me. "That means you'll be skiing with your family from now on. That's how a family vacation should be, don't you think? I'll just be here to call turns and to keep you out of trouble."
And so I skied my first intermediate run with my family. It was smooth and easy. My body felt loose and graceful. I heard Brian, Mom, and Dad skiing up ahead. It was perfect.
"Oh, there's no place like home," I heard Brad chuckle as he skied behind me.
That's that.
And finally, and this is not by any means to end on a downer, but just to show that the book is not all cotton balls and rainbows, this next chapter is from a particularly harrowing time, and I think it's a harrowing time for everyone. And I think we'll go directly from this chapter into this song, "The Girl I Am." And just to let you know, "The Girl I Am" is a song that Jenny and I wrote together. Jenny has been my partner for 10 years plus, and we've not only been life partners, but we've been musical partners, and we met at Yale, and all she had to say to me was, "Will you sing on my clarinet recital?" And that was it, and we've been partners ever since, and we've collaborated. We're working on a new album that's coming out in the fall, and the title track, and I usually sing opera, you know, the boring stuff. No, I'm just kidding, but... It's not boring to me, but you know. But this album is really to reach out to all kinds of people who like opera, who like pop, who like jazz, who like folk. And the song is really about this harrowing experience I had in middle school where people told me, "Laura, you'll never have a job, you'll never have romance, you'll live off of government support your whole life, you'll probably live with your mom and be a burden on your family." And I was like Humpty Dumpty. I needed to be put back together again after that. And luckily, I was resilient, and I did have a supportive family that said, "Absolutely not. You're going to have a very full life.
But, you know, at the time, we were so vulnerable at that age. And there's so many, I mean, you hear these terrible things. In fact, in recent media, these things that happen to teenagers, awful, awful things. And what you always have to remember is that you are beyond that, and you're more beautiful, and that anybody can never know, and that you will rise above that, no matter what identity issues you have, whether it's you're too short, you're too skinny, you're too tall, you're too fat, you've got pimples, you're not the right race, you're not the right culture, you're not the right this, you don't speak English well enough, whatever it is, that everything's going to get better, and your life is, so this song is really a letter to those people from me, letting them know that it gets better. But so we'll go right into it, and I'll start, this is a little chapter called the Babysitter's Club. The seventh grade had its first dance party on a beautiful night at the end of October. It was held in Stacy Cambridge's huge backyard in Beverly Hills, which was booming with the deep bass of Boys to Men, Color Me Bad, and Criss Cross. Yeah, I know I'm old. Mom had dropped me off in the midst of kids struggling to be heard over the loud music. It was the pool party all over again, my searching for friendly voices amongst the indistinguishable mess of sound. Dana and Courtney were nowhere to be found. "Okay, ladies and gents," said a cheerful DJ, "ready for your first ballad? Go find yourselves the cutest dance partner. I'll give you about a minute." Just like finding a group to work with in English class, finding a dance partner proved difficult as couples began forming around me. "Yo, David," I called, hearing one of the boys in my section talking to another guy. "Want to dance?" I asked. "Well, okay, but don't get the wrong idea," he said. "Don't flatter yourself," I chuckled. "I actually have taste." This made David laugh nervously, and I was proud of my quick wit. We danced awkwardly in silence. After a minute, we were growing sweaty and uncomfortable, and the end of "I Can't Let Go" by Mariah Carey couldn't come fast enough. When Mariah hit her last whistle tones of the song, David squirmed away from me as if escaping the jaws of a huge whale. Dana's and Courtney's laughter could finally be heard in the break between songs. "Hey, guys," I said cheerfully. "Having fun?" "Yeah," Dana said. "Haven't danced as much as you, though, Lori." "How is David?" "A warm body to dance with," I said. "Ooh, I think he heard you. He's standing right behind you," said Courtney. I wheeled around humiliated, anxiously thinking of something to say to smooth it over. "Just kidding," Courtney laughed maniacally. You're gullible, aren't you?" "Don't ever do that to me again," I sighed with relief. "I think you just caused my first gray hair." "You already have several, didn't you know?" Courtney said, trying to sound innocent. "Yeah, funny," I said. "Very, very funny." "I'm going to get punch," Dana said. "Want anything?" "Nah, thanks," I said. "So who are you hoping to dance with?" I asked. There was no answer. I tried again. Still no answer. Dana and Courtney had gone off together, not telling me to follow, not adding me to their evening of whispering about cute guys. I stood there, feeling my heart sink, wondering why they always made a point of finding each other at parties, at lunch, or anywhere else, and would never look to find me. As the evening wore on and I danced like an idiot all by myself, my mood worsened. During a short lull when the DJ had evidently taken a bathroom break, I heard Dana and Courtney again. I headed in the direction of their voices. "Hey," again, I said. "Oh, hi, Lori," they said in unison. This time I was ready when their voices began to trail off. "Wait!" I shouted over the crowd. "I thought we were friends," I said. "I thought we were having a good time at lunch." Dana and Courtney did not say anything. At first, I thought they had walked away again. But then, "What's wrong?" Dana said. "I just don't understand why you keep leaving me behind tonight and why you never look for me during lunch. I always have to find you." "Lori," Courtney said firmly, "it's just that we don't always want to babysit you. You know what I mean?" "Babysit? Whoever said anything about babysitting me?" Without any warning, my eyes were filling with tears. I hated myself for crying. I was doing what they expected, what they were most afraid of. I was the fragile thing they felt obligated to protect, and they had made me cry. But who wouldn't have cried if they had been told that? What seventh grader wouldn't have been humiliated by Courtney's proclamation? "Well," Dana began hesitantly, "it's just that
we don't always want to have to look out for you all the time. You know what I mean? When have I ever asked you to look out for me, to do anything for me? I challenged, barely coherent. You're asking us to come find you. Don't you think that's making us look out for you? Courtney helped out Dana. Don't you find each other? I argued. Isn't that something you do? Is that because you like each other's company, or is it just that you're looking out for each other and I'd just be one too many to look out for? It's just different, they said together, as if they had planned it. As I stood there crying and shaking with rage now, I realized that there was no reasoning with them. Far from forming my own babysitter's club, I found myself on the outside of one. I was merely an unwanted babysitting client. The middle school experience I had immersed myself in my imagination had turned on me. I let Dana and Courtney walk away, and I counted the minutes until Mom would be there to take me home. I give you a topic. The Civil War was neither civil nor a war.
Can we turn the volume up a little?
Volume on the piano? Okay. Yeah, is that good? Yeah. Balance? Mm-hmm. Okay. Welcome to our sound check. Okay.
How my life should be. Don't try to
tomorrow cries herself to sleep. Don't fret, it's not the end. Just take a look inside yourself to know the best in you. Now I know life's rich surprises, and I know that you will too. I share the moonlight with my love, and I laugh with my friends. I make the best of memories, and I don't want life to end. If anyone should knock you down and take your dreams away, just get right up and stand up tall, and this is what you
Well, thank you very much. Crisscross, eat your heart out. We've got about 5-10 minutes for questions, if anybody has a question. And when, okay, John on our left here.
Oh, Lori, that was so beautiful. Wow.
Oh, thank you.
Wow.
Thank you.
I mean, the music and the feeling. But I'm an old guy. I'm 72.
Awesome. That's great.
And I love opera.
Yay.
And I would love to know what you love to sing.
You know, we, Jenny and I, have been doing... the first half of our concerts is always a lot of classical. So we do arias. We do, like, the Carmen aria, the Habanera. We do Noble Seigneur, which has been one of my mezzo arias, because I happen to be sort of a coloratura mezzo, which means sort of a high, you probably know, a high mezzo that does a lot of the florid passages of arias. And we love doing things that are kind of rare, but also just jewels, like Sibelius, which is Swedish. And they're just some gorgeous songs of his. We love doing Fauré. Just recently, I had a piece written for me by the composer Bruce Adolph, which was a setting of a poem he asked me to write, which is actually included in the book. It's called Do You Dream in Color? And that's when he asked me to write that poem, and I ended up writing it. That's when actually the book started to take off, because then I sort of had a direction for the book. But so that piece of music is something we've been doing. And I'll be doing the world premiere of the orchestral version in Switzerland next month. But actually, I'm doing a concert at Barge Music, which is in Brooklyn on Saturday, and I was taking out the old Brahms stuff that I haven't done in like 15 years. And I was like, oh my God, I love this stuff. And I hadn't sung it in so long. It was like Von Ewige Liebe and Die Weihnacht and Wie Melodie and just gorgeous stuff. And so I'll be doing all German concert of that kind of material. So I really love doing a lot. And I love doing Baroque music. There's really nothing like these dissonances that you hear in Handel and Monteverdi. And Rossini. Rossini's a biggie. I love doing the bel canto stuff because it's all over the place. And when you do it, I always tell people it's like skiing. You kind of ski all over the map and all over the staff. And I just love that feeling of doing those florid passages. So that's sort of the short version of the question. You're like, I shudder to think what the long version would be.
Lady with her hand up about 4 rows back.
Hi, Lori. I'm another mezzo, and I loved hearing your voice.
Oh, thank you.
So I don't know very much about Braille, and I wanted to know, is it possible to write out music in Braille? Is that how you learn your music, or do you learn it all orally, A-U-R-A-L-O-Y.
Right.
And also, if you wanted, if like not anyone, if there aren't more questions and you wanted to throw us a habanero or something, that would be awesome.
Oh! You know, we would love to. And the only thing is that this keyboard doesn't have a music stand. Otherwise, Jenny would gladly play that and we would do it. But in terms of your Braille question, there is Braille music. I'm one of the guilty culprits of not really being good at sight reading Braille music, because I learned it kind of late, and I had already discovered what the staff, I was visualizing what the staff looked like, because I had so many people describing it over the years, that when Braille music was introduced to me, it was quite linear. And here's something that I've never been able to get over. The Braille note, eighth note D, the Braille eighth note C, is actually the literary D in Braille, so I'm always subconsciously transposing. And so I figure, you know, it's just easier to do stuff by ear rather than all these little technical things that slow things down. But there are several blind people, including the pianist who won the Van Cliburn a few years ago, who use Braille music brilliantly, and I don't know how they do it, and I'm just amazed. But yes, it does exist, and I tend to do everything by ear.
Right in front here, Dan.
Hi, Laurie. I spoke with you briefly on Marty's show. I'm really interested in knowing, you touched on in your reading tonight about learning Braille at a different school from your brother, and then going to, were you in the private school by the time that was middle school?
Right, exactly, through high school, exactly.
So mm-hmm. I'm really interested because I'm a couple decades older than you. Mm. When everybody... almost everybody went to schools for the blind, and my twin brother and I were some of the first to leave in ninth grade. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of wondering what the atmosphere was like around mainstreaming in schools for the blind, and if there was any consternation about switching schools and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Actually, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because I have a chapter in my book called Mainstreamed, and that's when I talk about how I made that switch. And there was a little bit of consternation in the sense that I think they claimed at the school that I went to, and I have to tell you that these people who said that were some of my biggest supporters and advocates, so I almost feel guilty saying this, but at the time, they were saying to my mom, no, we just don't do that. We don't, our totally blind kids don't get mainstreamed. So there was definitely a hierarchy of the partially sighted ones. The more sight you had, the more likely it was for you to matriculate into a mainstream situation. But for me, it was just unheard of for somebody like me to be mainstreamed completely. And even my mom had to fight the fight to get me even into a public school with a resource room for the blind. But she did, and even then, it was like, no, you're not teaching her how to use the VersaBraille. You probably know what the VersaBraille is, but for those of you who don't know, it's this big dinosaur of a machine that has six keys on it with the Braille combination, and it's really what it's meant to do is you can actually have things printed in print, and it was a little bit, at the time it was cutting edge, but my mom said no, she's going to learn how to type, because that's what's going to get her into the sighted world and the world out there. People aren't using VersaBrailles at work, and so that's how, that she really fought, and I think she was really going against the grain with me. And in terms of my school, when I went to Oakwood, which is a great school, and I have to say that they really worked hard because they were really unsure of how I would fit into the environment there. But they went to my public school and they saw how I did things. And of course, for me, I was angry because I thought I was under the microscope and why couldn't I just be a normal kid? And in the end, they wanted to make sure that I would be successful at their school. But when I got there, my mom was getting calls like twice a week. We don't know if Lori's paying attention in class, da 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 da. And my mom was like, why do you say that? And they said, well, I don't know. She's just not looking at me when I talk, So, so there was definitely a lot of dissonance, and it was almost like I was speaking a foreign language, of course, and I never realized that. I just felt like I was a normal kid. But, and especially the sighted kids, I think a lot of times there was a little bit of resentment. And there was one time, I'll just tell this little story that it's sort of in the book as well, but when I was in seventh grade, they pulled me out of class telling me there was a lab that was too visual. But what ended up happening is they wanted to talk to the kids about me. They had some social workers come in, and they wanted to find out what they thought of me. Which gave them license to totally go, well, this, 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 and this. And it set a precedent, which I will never forgive that, because it was just I don't think that's the way to handle a situation, and especially to make me completely in dark, a blind person be completely in the dark about. But at the same time, I knew they were doing what they felt was best. And so there were a lot of things that they did do because it was so foreign to them that, you know, did go against, you know, the norm. And so I just felt at the time like it was hard. And I think now it's gotten easier. A lot of my friends who are like a generation younger than me, you know, are mainstreamed. And they still deal with, I guess, difficulty and discrimination sometimes. But for the most part, I think it's just more normal to see blind kids in public schools and things. So it's definitely gotten better. You know, slowly getting better. We were in the 50s maybe when I was, you know, in the 80s growing up. Now we're maybe in the 70s.
Some more, lots of questions. Kitsy in the middle here, and then the lady on the aisle.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
That was a pleasure.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your writing and revision process. You know, you were saying you didn't know how to write, but you write beautifully.
Oh,
and
thank
I
you.
Just wondered what your process was.
Ah, okay. Well, I always loved to write, and in fact, I was writing these. I was a columnist for this one website called With TV, which was a disabilities TV station website, which they were hoping to actually become a channel, and I think they're still working on it. But in the meantime, it was an interactive website, and I was writing blog posts for that, and sort of getting into that memoir state of mind. But in terms of starting the writing process for my own life, fiction is a lot. I thought at the time a lot easier than to write about your own life because I thought, you know, my life is pretty darn mundane. Who's going to be interested in this stuff, you know? So what I did was I met with somebody, and it wasn't a writer per se. It was somebody that he called himself a writing consultant. So in other words, instead of going to a writing school and workshopping, I met with this person, and he, and in a way, it was more like having a social or a psychologist just sitting and listening to me. And he never really said, okay, this is how you're going to do your book. But he kind of said, just write it. And he gave me permission. And I think that's really how I started writing the book. And because of that encouragement, because of somebody just saying, yeah, that's totally interesting. And yeah, write that. And, you know, getting me to brainstorm and sort of digging out the more interesting parts of my life, that's how I began. And also, when Jenny and I would be just having dinner together and talking, she'd say, you know, you've got to write about this. This is, makes me so mad. You've got to write about this, you know. And then we'd both get mad, and I would go home and write it, you know. So there was, you know, stuff like that. And it wasn't all about being mad. I mean, most of the book is joyful and about all these great experiences I've had. I think it was just mostly that. And I did take a couple of writing classes. I took a memoir writing class, and I got some wonderful inspiration from the teacher and also the other students who were really fabulous writers. And in fact, we were in this loft in Soho of this gentleman who had a very famous restaurant in New York, and he was writing about it. So very inspiring people to be around, and that really helped as well. And then actually the poem is really the final straw, because when Bruce, the composer, said, I want you to write about your blindness, I thought, well, what do I want people to know about my life? And I wanted them to know that my life is colorful, that I dream in color, and not literally, but that I really dream in, I dream, I make jewelry, so I definitely think of color, and I wanted to write. So what I did was, after writing that poem, I thought, why don't I write red, I'll write a poem about the color red. And then the next line of the following chapter was, red is the color of the dress I wore for the event I sang with John Williams. And so every color had a context in my life. And so that's, I went from there. And so it was a many layered process, and it didn't all happen at once. And it was very, I think, lucky and fortuitous how things happened the way they did. Mm-hmm.
And
Hi, my name is Karen. I heard you on Radio Times today also.
Oh, cool.
And I wanted to ask you a couple quick questions. One, yeah. What kind of oxygenated water do you drink that you mentioned? And also, we hear often about other singers who are blind, and mm-hmm. I was wondering if you were inspired by other, we mostly hear, I guess, well, I can think of three male singers. I wonder if there are several women singers that might have, who are blind, who might have inspired you that you can tell us about that we might not have been introduced to.
Oh, who are blind, interesting. Well, you know, it's interesting. Well, about the first question, just because it's easy to tell you. Perfect Water, it's the name of the brand. It's actually distributed by the company Amway, which but the water, I love a lot of their products, but the water is, I was scared of it for like 2 years. I wouldn't touch it. I was like, oh no, I just want to drink regular water. I don't want anybody to touch my water with any chemical or whatever. But everybody was like, Laura, it's just oxygen. Just drink it, you know? And I was like, oh, okay, finally. So I finally took the leap of faith and drank it. And I didn't expect anything to happen, but what I had heard is that a lot of athletes like it because, like a lot of these, I guess there was a company that was called Water Joe or something, and it was like something similar. But what ends up happening is these athletes use it because it gives you more air support, breath support, endurance. And there's actually a little test, a demo that they have you do when you drink the perfect water. You have to do a certain flexibility exercise, and when you drink the perfect water, supposedly you can bend a little bit more further or something. I don't know. But I remember thinking when I first started drinking, I was like, wow, my technique is suddenly getting a lot better. Why is that? It's the perfect water every time. If I didn't have it, I noticed a big difference. So it's my little trick. But and in terms of blind musicians, I love Andrea Bocelli, and I love Stevie Wonder, and actually we're on the board of the same organization, so that's kind of cool, even though I've never met him. I hope we do someday, but supposedly a really nice guy. And I love Ray Charles. I love that music. Would I say that they're my role models? Not exactly, not because I don't want them to be my role models, but I think our styles are so different that, you know, I would think more of my role models, I think of Barbara Streisand, for example, because I was so, she was Jewish, and we have the same nose, as people like to tell me. And, you know, she's this inspiring, not only as a singer, with this gorgeous voice. I just love her artistry, but she's also a director and an actress and a many faceted artist, and I relate to her more. But I certainly do admire Andrea Bocelli, and actually, I guess now that we're doing a pop album, I can say that maybe he is one of my role models, because he crosses over. There's a jazz singer, and I'm drawing a blank on her name, Diane something. Yes, thank you. Yeah, Diane Schultz, right. And I think that's really cool. I have to listen to more of her stuff. And apparently there's an indie artist named Heather Hutchison or something. I've never heard any of her music, but I would say that I think, based on what people have told me, that she would be more along the lines of somebody that I would listen to a lot. So that's I hope that's a good enough answer. I think there's a blind person that really is a role model in the sense that there was a young man who won the Van Cliburn competition a few years ago, who was blind, and I just thought that was so cool because he was a classical musician. I had always had a hard time with judges and competitions, as I told you. So the fact that he won over some judges and won the biggest piano competition in the world was really staggering to me. So I really admire that, absolutely.
So I think we've got time for one more question before we maybe move into a song or two. Yeah, lady on the aisle.
Hi, Laura. My name is Jennifer Jocelyn.
Hi.
I just have two questions.
Sure.
One of the questions is, you talked about in your book about your past obstacles that you had because you were blind. So how do you feel about your accomplishments that you have accomplished today? And what do you say about people that are struggling to make it to their success? What message do you have for them?
The first part of your question is that I think it was sort of indicative of how I felt this evening, where when I was getting this introduction, I almost started crying, and Jenny always says, "Laurie, don't cry," but I'm always so shocked when people are edifying me. You know, I'm just always so shocked because, I mean, I was always edified by my family, and I was always admired for, you know, my singing and artistry, and even admired for things that I don't think I should be admired for, like brushing my teeth, you know, as a blind person. But, you know, that's, you know, just basic function. But anyway, I think, you know, I think that I feel so, like, my dreams are coming true, you know? I did an opera, and it was a one-woman opera, and I'm on stage, and there was a lot of people in the audience that were from New York. And this man comes up to me afterwards, and turns out he was a judge that had basically, he was one of the ones that was like, oh, you'll never make it, and, you know, you can't compete with sighted people on stage. You're just never going to make it, you know. And I looked at him, and I said, okay. And I thought to myself, oh, now I really want to make it, gosh darn it all, you know, because, and instead of feeling discouraged, he made me just wanted to prove him wrong. Well, after the opera, he was there and he said, I think I've heard you before. When will I get the chance to hire you? So tables have a way of turning. And I think to myself, it's surreal when those things happen, you know, because you hope and dream about those things. But I think after those past obstacles that, you know, dealing with that kind of stuff, like it's always amazing to me that the same people who were what I quote call the quote naysayers have suddenly decided that they see an opportunity in me. And then I realize that people are educatable. They're teachable. And that, you know, nobody's a bad person and nobody's purposely discriminating. And that I've always had the motto of just, my life is about educating people, and I just have to, every day, even when it's irritating, you know, and I'm like, oh, I just want to be a normal person, I just realize I have to educate people. And what I would say to young people, especially young blind people today, and I do have some really nice young friends who are blind, and I really see myself in them, and I would just tell them, don't believe the naysayers. Believe your mentors, because you'll have plenty of them. Believe the people who see the beauty in you, because those are the people that you need to help you guide you on your path. And those could be your parents. Those could be like a famous opera singer or, you know, a pop singer, whatever you want to be. And the other thing I would say to them, know who you are. Know what makes you awesome and special. What's the best part of yourself. And use that, build your skill set so much so that you can utilize that. And of course, okay, I've got one more thing because I'm long-winded, is that your Achilles heel is, which well, I guess some people would call my blindness is my Achilles heel, that can also be your greatest strength. Because if you can build upon the compassion that you've learned from the obstacles you've dealt with, if you can build upon being better than you know, the average person because you've had to your whole life, that will be your greatest strength. And the ability, the fact that I get to talk to you and share this book with you, I mean, I'm very lucky. And so I kind of feel blessed. I really do. And I've really never thought of my blindness as a weakness, except in rare situations. And I think that's what I would tell people. Use the weakness as your biggest strength. Find a way to see that as the most beautiful part of yourself. Sure. Oh, just one or two songs. Okay. So, Jenny, is the music stand? I think they want us to do a couple of numbers. So we're going to do, should we do I think they requested Habanera. Is that okay? Yes. So we'll do Habanera for you. and then we'll do the Leonard Cohen Hallelujah. And I'm going to make you guys sing with us because we're going to make all of Philadelphia hear us, I promise you that. So we're going to start with Habanera. Is that okay? Music stand okay? Okay? Are you sure? Okay. Oh, can we have the piano volume up a little? Is that it?
Regarde à toi si tu ne m'aimes. guarda tutto.
Okay, so we're going to make you all sing with us now for Hallelujah.
I heard there was a secret chord that David played, and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you? It starts like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing Hallelujah.
Ready? Oh, I hear the singers. I love it.
Faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty and the moonlight overthrew you. She tied you to a kitchen chair. She broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the Hallelujah.
Brave, come and do harmony.
Hallelujah. Well, baby, I've been here before. I know this room, I've walked this floor. I used to live alone before I knew you. I saw your flag on the marble arch. It's not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken. Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Oh, I love it.
Doesn't matter which you heard, the holy or the broken.
my best, it wasn't much. I couldn't feel, so I tried to touch. I told the truth, I didn't come to fool you. And even though it all went wrong, I stand before the Lord of Song with nothing on my tongue but hallelujah.
Thank you so much. It was so nice to meet you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.